Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our topic this morning is moral judgment. How to judge without being improperly condemnatory, which is, of course, just one of two problems very common among people in general and objectivists in particular. One problem is jumping to denounce someone on slender evidence, thinking that that shows that you are a moral judge and are taking moral issues seriously. The other problem is being aware that you can't jump without evidence, protracting the search for evidence into infinity, and continuously in actual reality remaining agnostic and saying, I don't know enough yet, I can't decide yet, so I'm still on the fence. Now, both of these approaches fail to grasp the place of moral judgment and the proper means by which it should be conducted. And I'm going to give you some ammunition against both in our discussion today. The source of this lecture, and I may say also the one on Friday, is the OGC, the Objectivist Graduate College Center, where I meet weekly with a group of graduate students and PhDs, and they have to hand in what we call a confusion paper, which within the limits of one type page has to take some major philosophic issue and state everything that they do not understand about it. Getting a little hum here. And some of the papers are highly technical and therefore highly dubious as to what is the point. But a couple of them raised real practical down-to-earth questions of what to do in daily life. And I've picked two of the best of those to give you today. And this particular individual, both of the individuals responsible for these papers are in this room, and I asked each if they wanted credit for being the inspiration, and even when I quote from their papers, and they vigorously disavowed that. So, so if I say he or she, it doesn't mean anything, because it might be just literary, or I might deliberately reverse them. Anyway, this particular man wanted to know, how do you judge someone to be evil? When does someone qualify as evil? And more specifically, can you compare degrees of evil? Can you range individuals on a scale, a continuum, going from, say, John Galt or Ayn Rand as the extreme of the good, all the way through Immanuel Kant or Adolf Hitler as the extreme of the evil, and everybody coming somewhere on this continuum? Now, I think you can see that even as a theoretical goal, the attempt to range mankind on this sort of moral continuum would raise many tortuous, not to say insoluble, questions. Just as a simple one, when you come to putting them in order near the more away from the perfectly good, where do you put Gail Winans and Andre Taganov? Who is closer to the good? Who is closer to the bad? And then you just come from an overbearing room service waiter, irresponsible and hostile. Now, Winans destroyed men's integrity, and Andre Taganov was responsible for murder. Now, here's this room service waiter. Does he come between them? Is he worse? So you can see that there are mammoth problems. We are hopefully today not going to try to give you that range, but just take two examples that were given in the paper, and after some preliminary try to judge, are these people evil, either one? If they both are, is one worse than the other? And how would you properly delimit your relations with people who have virtues and flaws such as these? And the student was concerned that he said, I know how to judge Kant and Hitler. And I know how to judge, you know, heroes of morality. But the hard thing is ordinary people who aren't philosophers or geniuses or criminals. They're not mass murderers or inventors of new systems. And they're not innovators for good or for evil. And they have a mixture of traits. And that, of course, is the very, very hardest to try to judge. And unfortunately, that is what you spend most of your life dealing with. It's very rare that you have tea with Hitler or, you know, with an objectivist eminence who, let us say, is on the side of the good. Now, I'm going to give you at the outset his description, and then you just, of these two people, you just keep it in mind, and we'll go through some preliminary discussions and then come back. Ed, I assume these are made-up names. The student described him as an intelligent, but these are people he actually knew, an intelligent man but no genius, mostly self-educated, chose a career he loved, married a woman he loved, raises his children well, tries to be happy. Sounds good so far. Experiences a lot of unearned guilt, mainly from religious influences, which have prevented his happiness and destroyed the enjoyment of life he could have had. And the student says, and I quote now directly, I do not believe this man is capable of redemption. He is not capable of understanding his errors, nor does he have the motivation to do so, unquote. Now, he speaks presumably from some knowledge of the man, since it's a relative of his. So he describes a virtuous, value-pursuing man who is miserable and irredeemably ignorant. Classify him morally. Now we got another one, Dick. Dick is a more educated, intelligent man who is a professed objectivist, knows the literature well, and has a career he loves. So it sounds like already this is better. But, the description goes on, he has married a Freudian feminist psychology professor. And furthermore, he habitually steals from hotels as he travels frequently. Ed would never steal nor put up with that psychologist. Dick would never succumb to religious ideas of unearned guilt. Ed is unaware of and not interested in getting better ideas. Dick is aware of ideas yet frequently evades them. So, who is better? Well, let's just see by a show of hands right now. We'll discuss these cases later. If you think one or both of these individuals can be described as evil, raise your hand. Well, I got a reasonable number of takers there. If you had to choose morally between the two of them, which do you think is morally superior? How many think Ed, the religious one, is better? Oh, big show of hands. And how many think Dick? Very few. Now, is your big problem with Dick his wife or his stealing? How many think the biggest problem with Dick is his wife? Reasonable number. How many think that it's his stealing? Okay, well, you've given me a perfectly straightforward... How many think that these two are completely moral, whatever other mistakes they may be making? Well, let me reword that since I don't have one taker. How many think that a properly interpreted, filling in the background which we are not given, both of them could be completely moral? Well, that changed a lot. Well, how do you know that background isn't true since I didn't say it? And yet you're already convinced that, a lot of you are convinced that they're evil. Well, this is what we want to do now. is organize some understanding of how to pass those sort of judgments in general and then come back and apply them to these two cases. Obviously, you know some elementary points which I'm not going to repeat. It's very crucial that we distinguish in all moral judgment between moral breaches and errors of knowledge. We also, it's very important, but difficult to do correctly, it's very important to distinguish what problems or errors do they have psychologically in their consciousness, and what errors or actions or achievements can they claim existentially. Because moral judgment has to be a combination of both. It's not purely psychological and it's not purely existential. And then, what is your purpose if you're trying to compare the two as what? As candidates for the Atlas Shrugged movie? As babysitters? As friends? As what? You can't just, in a vacuum, list some traits and say, okay, obviously this one is better because you want to know better by what standard for what. But above all, we have to start, if we want to know whether these people are evil, by understanding what we mean by evil. Not everything which is non-good is evil. There are a great many concepts in English designating a major departure from total goodness or total virtue. Now, if we wanted, we could have an entire lecture, more than that, on simply the terms in English that denote major departures from virtue. And I could just go on and on. Corrupt, depraved, reprehensible, monstrous. There's endless if you look in the thesaurus. But having gone through all this, I say that leaving aside linguistic, which I don't purport to be a lexicographer, leaving that aside, I think there are five main concepts that name something important that would have to be distinguished. And then a lot of the other terms are metaphors synonyms or just empty denunciations without a special content. So I focus on these five. I don't say that if I spent years studying it, I wouldn't add a sixth. But these five I know are crucial. And just keeping them clear will help you decide what you're trying to judge when you judge somebody negatively. Let's start with bad. This is a very, very general term. It's the most generalized negative assessment you can make. And it makes no difference as far as bad is concerned. How bad, what the scale of the negative is, what the intention of the person was, how conscious they were, none of that. And it's not even confined to morality. You can have a bad boy, a bad man, but a bad dog, a bad apple, a bad runner, a bad day. So all it tells you is that in some sphere of activity, there is some kind of standard of value. And for some reason, maybe volitional, maybe not, the performer did not live up to that standard. But it may imply nothing morally, as in the case of an apple, it may be inexorably determined from the history of the universe. But still, judged by the standards of a blooming, healthy, edible apple, this thing covered with rot is bad. Now that's a very safe thing to say. therefore, because it's so generalized and commits you to very little. Now let's go to immoral, which is a specific type of badness. And that, I would say, is the first of the serious negatives. Because just he did a bad thing leaves open. But he did an immoral thing conveys for the first time two crucial additional points of information. Morality is not just a value standard, but a value standard pertaining to what are your different moral values from, for instance, aesthetic values or athletic values, etc. Morality governs man's actions in fundamental terms across his whole life. And therefore, if you violate a moral standard, your badness is not simply departure from some concrete set of goals like being a great runner or whatever. It's a departure from the fundamentals that man requires for survival. And since it's morality, it cannot be dictated by actions outside of your control. It has to be a volitional action, one which you did not have to take, which you chose to take. So I would say when you call an action immoral, you are implying two things over and above that it doesn't meet a standard. It doesn't meet the standard of fundamental values, and it doesn't because the person chose not to. Now that right away, you can see, is a much more significant denunciation. Even so, and I stress this, even within the limit that an immorality is always serious, there can be, let us say, venial and mortal immoralities, like venial and mortal sins. Now, James Taggart, for instance, wants to destroy the universe and everything good in it, and acts accordingly. Now, that is a massive immorality. His whole life is devoted to immorality. Now, on the other end, a teenage boy writing a crucial exam the next day, he knows that he's got to study, and he just evades, says, oh, to hell with it, I'll get by somehow, and goes off and takes pot but doesn't inhale. Now, that is a relatively minor immorality. He's still going against the principles of value achievement and that his life requires. He's evading, but you don't put him in the category of gold. Nevertheless, you certainly put him in a far different category from the bad dog or the bad apple or the bad runner. An immorality, however minor, is significant enough that you must identify it, either you as the perpetrator or you as the onlooker wanting to deal with the person. It must be identified. Their victims, if any, must be compensated. And the person must give signs of repairing his psychology, repairing that about him which led to this or which made it possible. Now, sometimes all he has to do is say, I see clearly the evil of this, and I was carried away, etc., and so on, and I won't do it again, and you can take his word. But by the second, third, fourth time, that's not enough. Why is this desire so insistent? Why does he give in on it all the time? Why is it so hard to do his schoolwork, etc.? Until you have evidence that the person has compensated any victims and repaired himself, you are on notice, waiting for proof, and you are right to have a gingerly watch and see attitude. Now, we've been talking about when an action is immoral. When a person is immoral, that is much, much more serious a statement. Because to say a person is immoral is to say that he characteristically takes immoral actions. And that makes him undealable with. Because it's not some delimited realm, but that's his nature as he's made it, what Aristotle calls his second nature. And that will merge into some of the later classifications. But then just to summarize immoral, this is to describe somebody as immoral is a factual description of an objective relation between his chosen behavior and a fundamental value. It's classifying the action as pro or anti life in principle, and within the framework that he chose it. All right, now let's get to some juicier ones. Vicious. V-I-C-I-O-U-S. Unrelated to viscous, was just an attitude of fluids. Of course, the opposite of immoral is moral, and the opposite of vicious is virtuous. There's not really an opposite to some of these, but in this case. Now, these words derive from vices and virtues, respectively. A virtue, in the objectivist definition, is a course of action that will lead to the attainment of a value. A vice is a course of action that will thwart, destroy, lead away from the attainment of a value. So what do you think vicious or virtuous pertains to? It's not simply a given action departs from the ultimate standard, but rather what? Well, is really what it amounts to is this man's behavior is characteristically exhibits vices, whereas this man's behavior is shot through with virtues. Now, man's character and action is ultimately integrated. Whatever contradictions you have, you cannot maintain them unchanged forever unless you die before the consequences accrue to you. And if you remember, I'm not going to repeat the argument here, but in OPAR, are you all familiar with that acronym? Which I did not invent and resisted for a while, but it's very easy to do, to say. But in OPAR, I took every virtue and showed how it necessitated every other. And similarly, how every vice ultimately necessitated every other. It is exactly like a mixed economy. A mixed person is like a mixed economy. They are inherently unstable, and if the basic premises aren't reversed and the total change of direction enacted, they will end up betraying all the virtues. And so you can say there is an internal consistency to morality, just as there is an internal consistency to amorality. The end of the road of one vice, if you follow that road, is complete rejection of virtue, in which case you are vicious. Vicious means you display the ultimate unity of vices. Now, this makes you really bad, because it's not a question of one immorality or many immoralities. This means you have reached the stage where all or most of your behavior is governed by anti-life irrational principles. And your toehold on any significant virtue is fading, weak, contradictory. So you are a really bad person from whom we can expect just about anything, Because you're set in reverse, so you can see a vicious man is necessarily immoral. But an immoral man is not necessarily vicious. It depends how extensive his immorality is. When you get to vicious, however, you're not focusing on any one thing, however wicked. See, I used that word wicked. However wrong, but rather you're focusing on the fact that his whole character consistently is pointing him in that direction. Now that brings us to what I regard as four, wicked. Now I do not know an antonym for wicked. I can't think of an antonym except it perhaps absolute respect for your consciousness and your knowledge, which I guess would be a version of integrity, but there's no word in English for unwicked. Wicked pertains to the consciousness of the perpetrator, the degree to which the perpetrator is conscious of what he is doing. Now, obviously, if he thinks it's moral, then he's not wicked at all. He's simply mistaken. He doesn't even come under immoral. And going to the other extreme, to be entirely 100% conscious of the evil of what you're doing is impossible. Why is that? What philosopher was the first in history to say that no man could know the good fully in the forefront of his consciousness and still do the evil? Socrates, right. And objectivism certainly believes, I've been told I'm not supposed to use the word belief in relation to objectivism anymore because somebody thinks that makes it a religion. Objectivists endorse Socrates' view on that point. But the difference between us and Socrates is that Socrates was essentially a determinist. Once you saw the good, you had to act on it. Whereas objectivism says the essence of your choice is to let that knowledge remain in the forefront and dominate, control your action, or let it seep away, shift your mind, let it blur, or positively work to escape it by evasion. And of course, if you do that, you can have 100% knowledge on the tip of your mind, right there for you to grab, and you just blur it out. Well, understanding, therefore, that the two theoretical extremes don't apply here, there is nevertheless a continuum of degrees on this issue of consciousness. Perhaps the most innocent, we're speaking within the level of somebody doing something wrong. The most innocent on this continuum is just a complete, out-of-focus, irresponsible person. They're walking around in the days. They don't know what they're doing. They walk into someone and jostle them, and he falls under a truck. Now, this is not murder. They're just in a daze, and they don't know. Now, that is certainly a very undesirable and blameworthy state. That, however, would not be wicked. Wicked is when you get to the part of the spectrum where the person knows what he's doing, or to amend that correctly, he knows if he would want to know. It's there for him to know, and he's pushing it out. So he is, in practice, a willful, deliberate, conscious destroyer. Now he'll evade it like Hitler and Clinton and all the others do with all the noble things he's done, and you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and etc., and so on. Nevertheless, this guy has before his mind, in some terms, even if evaded, this is the carnage I'm going to perpetrate, and I'm doing it despite it, the fact that somewhere within me I know it's corrupt. That's what I take wicked to mean. It's a concept to designate setting your consciousness aside and defying your own knowledge of good and evil. So it's on the side of what people think of as the devil or the demon, even though in a literal sense, as Socrates indicated, there is no such thing. But you will find this, for instance, in nihilists, in what Ayn Rand calls haters of the good. Now, the relation between wicked and vicious really depends on what angle of a person's behavior you're looking at. In regard to wicked, you are asking, how massive is his evasion? And specifically, does he fly in the face of the good by his own definition? And by vicious, you're asking, how much of his character, in other words, of the rest of his actions, is infected or affected by this behavior that he's taking? And you can imagine different scenarios. I mean, ultimately, the destination is going to be the same. Because if you devote your consciousness to evading moral principles, you're going to start spreading up everywhere. And by vice versa, if you're going to engage in vices, it won't be very long before you've got to have massive evasions of what you know is good in order to continue it. So you're going to be wicked and vicious together. But temporarily and on a transition, you can say this person did a wicked thing, taking that as mean he knew better, and this was a willful flaunting of the good, where it hasn't yet spread to make him as a total vicious. So they are not synonymous, but closely related. One is the internal connection among his actions. One is the relation of his consciousness to his knowledge of value. And then, of course, morality or immorality is the relation of his actions to reality, to the standard of life. So there's three different: the actions to reality, the actions to other actions, and the actions to his consciousness. And those are the three poles, basically, that you have to look at when you start evaluating someone. It's not enough to know that he steals. What does he know about stealing? How does that relate to his other behavior, etc., in order to come up with a appropriate evaluation? And now, with this basis, I hope you don't find this all self-evidently linguistic, do you? Because there are valuable points here, even though I'm doing it as a linguistic. But language is not intolerable as long as, you know, there's some content that you're using. What I don't want to be is like professors I have had who come in the room and say, here is a table, and they put the words on the board and say, let's start with A. Now, who can think of seven uses? And, you know, they go on page and class after class, and you never get to is or table, because those are just, you know, that's beyond PhD. So you get to A, and then maybe a month later to here, and then we forgot why we're doing it, and it's the end of the semester anyway. Now that is the linguistic analysis that I think is bizarre. But hopefully this is not that. Now let's get to evil. Now, I reiterate, all these terms you can find linguistic warrant for different uses than the ones I'm defining. But I think the ones I'm defining capture a crucial philosophic element, and I like to keep them separate instead of just having an arsenal, you know, of curse words without much differentiation. evil. It's interesting we have such a rich language to denounce. Now, the only antonym to evil that I could think of is saintly or heroic, but even that is not a perfect. Evil is like the final net sum of the person's behavior. It pertains to the scale or scope or dimension of the destruction or harm he's perpetrating. The sheer amount of destructive consequences. Now, we know that evil is anti-life. The immoral is anti-life. Now, even though that is so, not every action directly and obviously produces a torrent of destruction. For instance, just an ordinary petty crime. But when an action or man across his life produces a massive rain of terror and destruction, well, I shouldn't say just terror because I don't want to be just dictators, then you have an evil person. A pickpocket, for instance, other things being equal, I would not say is evil. Now, of course, you can make anybody evil by saying, well, pickpocket is the violation of property rights. The violation of property rights implies a violation of all rights. The violation of all rights implies the rejection of man and of reason and reality. And that, of course, unleashes Hitler and makes possible Auschwitz. So, you know, by 30 steps removed, the pickpocket is Hitler. But the point is, it's 30 steps removed, and he's the last person who had any clue to it. So I would say he did a bad thing, he did an immoral thing. I'm not prepared to say without further investigation, is he wicked? Is he vicious? I would say things like, he's contemptible, he's pathetic, and even say he's disgusting, but that is an emotional report which doesn't tell you about him. Peter Keating, for instance, does a tremendous amount of bad things. I would not call him evil. Mr. Moen, you remember him in Atlas Shrugged? You know, the middle of the roader who wants to keep everybody happy. He is not evil. That doesn't certainly mean he's good. But now, taking the standard objectivist examples for the moment, Ayn Rand held that the most evil man in history is Kant. Why? The intensity of corruption in thought and in action. He subverted every essential of human thought and unleashed thereby every form of perversion and destruction of civilization. You don't need me to concretize that. And in this respect, although Hitler is evil, Kant is more, by the very definition of the scale of destructive consequences. Who created more destruction? Now, Hitler killed 6 million people. But why is Kant? And Kant killed nobody, except maybe graduate students who have a heart attack reading the Critique. But why is Kant still more evil? Louder. He created Hitler. So he created all the destroyers, or rather unleashed them. So every one of their wickedness redounds to him. He is therefore the literal fountainhead of all the depravity, culturally speaking and politically, in the last couple of centuries. He is therefore without doubt the most evil man ever. There's no case that we know of where man has produced that degree of corruption. Moreover, on the scale of wickedness, Kant beats out any dishonest philosopher. No one prior to him openly said to hell with reality. They all said, there's another reality, they had a fantasy, you know, this reality is here, but it'll get even better when we die and so on. But Kant came along and said, to hell with it, who needs it? Let's make our own. Now that is, if you're talking about the massiveness of an evasion, nothing could equal that. That's wickedness par excellence. Now, if you are evil, then obviously you're every other bad thing. You couldn't be evil and be the embodiment of virtues or have only, you know, one or two vices. It means your life is essentially dedicated to destruction. So your productive life is motivated by destruction. You are not independent. You have no integrity. You will lie if and when and as necessary. You know, justice means nothing to you, etc. In other words, you'll be vicious as well. There are degrees of evil, but they're degrees within the fact that they're all on the massive side of the spectrum. All right, now keeping in mind these distinctions, and more than just the linguistics, the actual content points that we have to remember. We go to 12:15? Somehow we lost a half an hour here. I want to make a few other preliminary points before we go over and decide these other questions. To judge morally, you cannot take an act or trait out of context. I've finished my survey now of terms. You can't take an act or trait out of context. You must paint a whole picture, including the errors of knowledge of the person, the effort they made to grasp the truth, and the scope of the results. And you may have very tricky cases like Andrei Taganov, who is presented as being morally innocent and yet quite willing to shed all the blood of innocent persons that his morality required. Now, I would not say, and neither would Ayn Rand, that Andrei is evil. But she thinks he is so tragically mistaken that suicide is the only proper form of atonement. The point here is that when you say evil, even if it's evil not as much as Kant or Hitler, you've shot the chute. That is an unforgivable dimension of corruption. I could even imagine a wicked act where a man in principle was forgivable. He was simply overcome by some temptation, and then he berates himself for flouting his own knowledge, etc., and so on. So you have to say, you did a wicked thing, but you're not, I don't necessarily regard you as evil. I'd have to watch and see. If and when you pronounce a man evil, then I say run for your life and never trust him again. Don't wait around for psychological reports, redemption. So when we judge a person's character, we know that a man takes an immoral action. What are some of the things we want to know? I'm repeating now just as summary. What else is relevant to assessing the man morally? How does this morality relate, or immorality relate, to the rest of his behavior? That'll be the issue of vice and virtue. How conscious is it? How much willful evasion? The more massive the evasion, the less trustworthy the person ever is. And that relates to the issue of how deliberate, and that's the wickedness issue. And above all, if he's taking immorality, there's going to be negative consequences. What scale of destruction is he actually perpetrating? Now, I want to stress again what I said a little while ago. There is a mental and a physical element in proper evaluation. And just to indicate that, I want you to imagine that Ayn Rand and Immanuel Kant lived in a salon somewhere and mused aloud. And they each came up with all of their ideas as we know them. But they never wrote it down, lectured. They just sat there and chatted. And Kant came out with a critique. Ayn Rand came out with Atlas, or the philosophy of Atlas. There were no books, no audiences, no followers. And then they died, and the world was as it had been before they were born. What would Ayn Rand's achievement have been in such a case? Actual, not potential achievement. It would all be gone. There would be nothing left. You could say, well, she used her mind well, but it was evanescent and disappeared. So she would not get credit for being the great unleasher of the good, etc. She, a woman who had interesting thoughts and just lay around and did nothing about it. And equally, if Kant came up with the most monstrous thoughts and then died and the thoughts evaporated, what destruction is he guilty of? Zero. In fact, each of these two had to have an entire mental and existential life. Of course, the existential life couldn't have existed apart from the mental. It had to be a union of both. On the one side, profound effort leading to a philosophy defending and unleashing creativity in the rational man. On the other side, profound wickedness, in other words, evasion, leading to the unleashing of the killers. So when you judge, you have to know what happened in consciousness and in existence. Now, in the middle of somebody's life, he may be doing corrupt mental things that haven't yet issued in monstrous action, although they will in due course. That's relevant. It doesn't exonerate him, but he's not as bad as someone who's gone the full shoot and carried out those actions in actual reality. So you want to keep your eye on the degree of evasion up here and the degree of harm, whether to himself or to the world. They're logically connected, and you want to be able to measure that. Now, judging the extremes is easy. As this student indicated when he handed in his paper, judging ordinary persons is much more difficult. Ordinary, we mean not a philosopher, a genius, or a criminal. Ordinary, no, not an innovator for good or evil. Usually an ordinary person is mixed. Now, of course, if you think of Eddie Willers, he is in a sense ordinary. He's not an innovator and so on, but he's extraordinary in his dedication to morality. But the ordinary person is mixed. And therefore extremely difficult to judge because being mixed, they have a set of contradictions, and you have no way to quantify in this realm or to know, since the person is inherently unstable and has to move in a bad direction if he doesn't change, you have no way to know how bad it's going to get, how fast. So your moral assessment really has to take the form of a hypothesis. I think that such and such a trait will hold in him for another year, at least as far as his work is concerned. You know, and of course it has to be on that basis rather than I know he's committed to, etc. Is an ordinary mixed person qualify as evil? Remembering that by ordinary just means he's not a philosopher, he's not a criminal. Does such a person qualify as evil? I would say not necessarily, not even dominantly, because being ordinary, following in the standard path, generally being concerned with, you know, social approval, they are not going to step outside the common field and become a real destroyer. Can an ordinary person be evil? Ordinary as against Kant or Hitler? How many would say no? An ordinary person cannot be evil. How many would say yes, he can be? Yes, you can have a very ordinary, unassuming individual. He was really a cesspool of corruption. I didn't give you corruption, but... And I'll give you some examples. A number of cases of two people in theoretically the same wrong position, and one you may have a low opinion of and the other is evil. Take a bureaucrat who works in the FTC. For one, it's a sinecure. It's an easy job, he gets paid. It's like the unearned and he's content. He's just a drone. For the other, he licks his lips in glee at the idea. There's another business I'm going to be able to throw sand in the gears of and raise hell and exert my power, etc., which he hastily covers up under the necessities of ecology and the public interest. Now, one of these is in motivation evil, and it's obvious to you which, even though neither is a philosopher. Or here's another example. A member of the teachers' union who just churns the lessons out of the book. And, you know, pickets if they try to hire someone outside the union. As against a member of that union who was a zealot for progressive education and enjoys crippling the student's mind and watching their, you know, expression of bafflement. Now, obviously, the second is evil. The first is a non-entity. What about this one? Two men who make their living reading horoscopes. One in the 5th century BC and the other in the General Electric building. Well, I don't think either of them are as such evil. The modern one is definitely a racket. We'd have to know a lot more to know how vicious the guy is. The ancient one could just be ignorance. Now, if you notice, Peter Keating was not evil, and Ayn Rand defined specific limits beyond which he could not go. When the departure from reality and the destruction reached a certain point, he had to back off. When he saw Gordon Prescott and the new wave of modern architecture with its depravity, it was too obvious even to him that this is rotten. And he just, it was more important to him to his own judgment than the social acceptance he had sought all his life. And by the same token, the worst thing in specific action he ever did was try to nag Lucius Hare into dying. But he didn't actually go around killing people or torturing them like some of the characters in Atlas Shrugged. So he was a conformist, but not a true power luster. He was dishonest with himself, but he didn't try to subvert the autonomy, the ability to live of the people around him. And the key, therefore, I think, for you is when you call something evil, it involves some kind of destruction. And therefore, its motive is going to be something like hatred, or nihilism. That's certainly, it's the 20th century dominant motive. For details, read The Age of Envy, which outlines how ordinary people can be evil in this very way. It is not that common, but it is unfortunately not that rare. This is an attitude that has been sanctioned and unleashed by Kant and his followers, and you can see a lot of it. And that is true evil. It hasn't reached the scale of Hitler or Kant, but it is on that track in the sense that the part of the person in operation is the part that wants to smash the good. And that element is evil, and then it's a question of how much it takes over, how soon. So you don't have to kill the victims yourself. If you have or you know someone who has an active element of that kind, by that fact you are contributing to the mass destruction of the people who have the weapons and the TV microphones. It's like you're a minor guard in the concentration camp, or you're digging a ditch. You're not the dominant evil, but you have your hand in it. Now let's take one more clarification, and then we're gonna go to Ed and Dick. How do you deal with people who have evil ideas which they can't help absorbing because of their breakup? Does that mean there's an element of evil in those people? Just an element. If people hold evil ideas that they were brought up with their teachers in grade schools and so on, does that mean there's an element of evil in these people? How many say yes? How many say no? Well, I'm definitely on the side of the majority. A man with an evil idea is not thereby evil. And you have to write that down. Now, there is such a thing as an evil idea, not just a mistaken idea, which is one that doesn't correspond to reality, but an actually evil idea, which means, by our definition of evil, an idea whose essence is destruction of something good. And I'll give you three right here. Socialism, God, and non-objective art. Socialism as an idea is the enslavement and destruction of the producer, which means of the mind. God is the assault on every human concept and therefore a direct assault on the mind. Non-objective art is an assault on all art and therefore on all human values. Those ideas are not merely wrong, they're evil. As against, and I could give you a whole list of ideas which are wrong, but not inherently evil. Hedonism. Naturalism in art. Aristotle's theory of the golden mean. Materialism, the way the ancient atomists held it. Now, if it's materialism, the way B.F. Skinner holds it, where he's out to annihilate consciousness and will, and he calls his book Beyond Freedom and Dignity, that is evil because of all that he's trying to destroy. So if somebody is coming up with ideas that you disagree with, the first thing you have to do is decide, besides these ideas being false, are they evil? And then, does the person holding the idea know the meaning and consequences of the idea? And if you don't know whether he knows, what's the simplest way of finding out? Ask him. Not only does he know, but ought he to know, given his position in life and the actions he's taking? For instance, if a young student in college says he advocates empiricism, And he takes that to mean all knowledge begins with experience. Perfectly okay. But if a college professor who knows the whole tortured history and collapse of the empiricist movement and how and why it leads to Hume stands for empiricism, by the fact of his position, you do not have to query him, did you ever study Hume and do you know where empiricism leads and etc.? If he didn't, he's guilty of criminal irresponsibility in accepting that position. So it is not true that if you don't know, you're always exculpated. There are many cases where you ought to know. It's like these mothers who say, you know, I left my kid in the car and I didn't know that it was going to get 110, you know, all afternoon. She didn't bother looking at the weather forecast. Now that is she's responsible for it, as wicked as if she, you know, tried to broil the kid alive deliberately. Now, by the way, the same issue applies in the other direction. Is a person with good ideas thereby a good person? How many say yes? How many say no? Right. He can be. But it altogether depends on, does he understand those ideas and are they integrated into his life? In my years in this philosophy, I cannot tell you how many people I have met, love Atlas Shrugged, so they say, gone to a whole bunch of lectures, they can run rings around their opponents and spiel the line on everything. And yet, their governing motive is a desire for status or power, or they just hate everybody anyway and they're looking for a platform to justify it. Or they're what Ayn Rand calls whim worshippers, and therefore they're attracted to a philosophy of selfishness because it tells them, as they hear, do whatever you feel and to hell with other people. Or it's all just a little castle in the air and has no relation whatever to their actual lives. Now, these people may preach great ideas and they may do so very lucidly, but the ideas are not a part of them. And therefore, rather than get credit for being such well-spoken people, they get blamed because it even shows the hypocrisy that they know enough to be able to talk like that and then betray it. That would show wickedness, you see. It would show the kind of consciousness they have. All right, now we're going to get to Ed and Dick before we run out here. Now you remember, I don't want to take time to repeat it again. Ed as described. Now what is the first thing when somebody gives you a description of traits A, B, and C? Do you say, okay, A, B, and C, now let me see. Or what do you say? Is it possible that these traits are coexist? Maybe he or I didn't observe correctly. Have I interpreted these traits correctly? But here's as given. Ed, I'm just going to give you the highlights. Intelligent, but not a genius. Self-educated, loves his career, loves his wife, raises his children well. Very guilty, religious, and the student says this man is not capable of redemption. He can't understand his errors, and he hasn't got the motivation to do so. As against Dick, educated, intelligent, unobjectivist. Knows the literature well, loves his career, but he's married to the Freudian feminist psychology professor and steals from hotels habitually. Now, we asked, are either of them evil? Now let me see by a show of hands in the light of our discussion. How many would say, I'm not going to make you elaborate, so don't worry about putting your hands up. How many would say at least one of these two is evil? I think that's a lot less than we had before. All right, if you had to choose which is worse of these two people, let us say which is more immoral. Well, let's put it another way. How many agree that both of these people are immoral? How many think that only one is immoral? That's equal, as far as I can see. And how many think neither are immoral? Well, we got a very small number for neither. All right, one more question I want to ask you. Which is worse? You have to choose. Ed, the religious one, or Dick, the Freudian feminist wife? Dick is worse. Does anybody think Ed is worse? You think Ed is worse? And were you brought up religiously? He said, for the record, he's not worried about the wife. They may have a great relationship. So your comment is not motivated by a pathological hatred of religion. All right, now let us look at these two closely and see if you come up. I'll tell you my answers. And my answers are not as cut and dried as yours, because my answers in all cases come down to what? It all depends on, and then we have to know more. On this basis, I would hesitate to judge. And the point of the exercise is to try to show you, you can't just grab off, say, immoral, worse, evil, da-da-da-da. Now let's take Ed. What is the major factual issue that is omitted in the description? And when I pointed it out to the person, he had an idea how to analyze him. Now I'll let you contribute until we start to run out of time, which is momentarily. What is the major issue that we do not have any answer to that's just given, that should stop you cold? And when you hear something like that, you should say, why? There's 100 different reasons that maybe this isn't even true. Now you can say he loves his wife, okay, I'll accept that. He loves his kids, I'll accept that. He went to school himself, okay, but where is the point where if you're thinking critically, you should be thinking, I gotta ask more here. Somebody over here, yes. What he is described as incapable of redemption because he's not capable of understanding his errors, and he does not have the motivation to do so. Now let's just say, is it possible for a person to be religious but be incapable of understanding his errors? Yes? Well, is he capable of understanding the view that he's advocating? On whatever level he understands it, he is on that level able to see what's wrong with it, able to see. Otherwise, you're in this position. You can imagine Santa Claus, but you just don't have the brains to imagine that he's not there. Now, that is not possible. If you are that stupid, that, you know, you can't figure out the possibility that Santa Claus isn't there, no matter whether you've been told it from morning to night, then your brain doesn't even have the capacity to fantasize Santa Claus. If you can imagine it, you can disimagine it too. So you can't put this down to he's just too stupid. Now a dog, okay, or a subnormal, but then they don't believe in God or have religion. They're just not up to it. So I think you'd have to say not true that he is incapable of understanding his error. He certainly may be incapable of tracing the fallacies of Aquinas or Anselm and, you know, etc. But you don't need that. You can talk about God without going into all of that stuff. But I think the much more important point is he doesn't have the motivation. Now, it's very important that you separate these two, because if he's truly incapable, and that were possible, this man is 100% moral. You can't ask him to do what he cannot do. So this man is just destined to be religious, and that's it. He's 100% moral. But obviously that can't be true for a self-respecting adult who is not psychotic. So the question is, he doesn't have the motivation to do so. Now let's assume that the gentleman, this I gather is an older relative of the questioner, and as such, you know, no one has the motivation to be philosophically purified by a young relative. And the same way is true, you could be the vessel of truth, but 99 times out of 100, you go up to your father and mother and say, I'm going to correct some of your thinking now. It's out the window. I mean, they're so used to looking at you as an infant potentially about to self-destruct that it's just impossible for them to change the view and say, yes, philosophic mentor, tell me what I should think of the universe. So if they don't have the motivation, because of you're a young relative, I don't count that as not having the motivation. You got to get someone on the person's level, age, etc., and so on. But let us suppose they really don't have the motivation. What does that tell you? Or put it another way, what might that tell you about the person? What are some possible explanations? You cannot say, and this is one of the key points, he doesn't have the motivation, therefore he's evil, therefore he's immoral, therefore he's... You have to have some idea. Why doesn't he? What is stopping him? Otherwise, this is to you a blank. It could cover relatively venial sins and horrible evils. And you can't tell if all you let go is he doesn't have the motivation. That's not a primary. Something has to come below it. And therefore, that's up to you to understand before you appraise the person. Now, for the sake of time, I want to just give you a few possibilities. He's a skeptic. He doesn't think anybody can know the truth about anything. Therefore, he doesn't want to be upset to change his views because it's all up in the air anyway. That is very unlikely, because he believes in God and he seems to love his wife and so on. He's not an intellectual type. So we'll close that one down. But it's theoretically a possibility. Or he needs a crutch. He wants social acceptance. He's like a Peter Keating type. And he doesn't want to reject religion and then just suddenly be, you know, out in the cold as some kind of intellectual weirdo when he doesn't even know the intellectual world and doesn't want it. That's already bad, but it's not necessarily the same as evil. Or the whole field of philosophy in his mind is useless and unintelligible, which is a very, very common attitude among Americans. They have no motivation because they think it's all esoteric abstractions that nobody could understand anyway. Now that on the face of it is innocent until and unless he's given the evidence. And it's sometimes very hard to crack through, but if you can say to him, you know, you have such and such a view of philosophy. But actually these issues are straightforward, they can be understood the same way you understand your job. Can be dealt with in simple English. There are definite answers if you can communicate that. Sometimes these people become enthusiastic. And if that were to happen, you'd say, this guy was just an error of knowledge. He had no motivation because he didn't know what philosophy was and he was open to hear. How about let's go in a bad direction now? Again, you see the different possibilities. He's full of self-doubt. Who am I to pronounce on the views of the ages? I'm nothing. I have to take, you know, what the consensus of wise men say. Well, now, this opens up a big can of worms, as they say, in regard to Clinton's tax forms. How would you relate this much self-doubt to the virtues in general? Now, if he has this kind of self-doubt, he certainly doesn't have pride. If he doesn't have pride, does he still aim at perfection in everything he does, or does he cut corners? Is he compartmentalized? He's okay at work, but, you know, he lets things go in other areas. How much has he let go? Now, you could let yourself go there, and right now, compatible with what we have, rage a whole picture of a vicious person. Hooked on this, and then you reappraise, and you see, you know, he's allegedly nice to his wife, but he's really threatened by her, and he does hostile things, and he's mean to his kids, and, you know, he's not really doing that well at work. And the reason he's so unhappy is, you know, he hates everything, etc. and so on. You can end up, I'm not saying that's true, but just once you know that serious self-esteem problem is at the base, that opens a possibility that this is all much worse than you thought. Or could it be from something else? I'm not saying you have to go through every one of these, but your mind has to be fertile enough so you, when you hear no motivation, you don't just say, okay, evil, you know. How old is he? Now, it makes a difference. Suppose this guy is in his 70s. And even if he hears, you know, that philosophy is the answer, he can understand it and so on, he feels it's just too late. You know, I don't have the time left. He's been very malevolent for so long, and he basically just wants to get by and give up. He's suffused with futility. Now there I would say, definitely prescribe Prozac. But you could say of a guy like this, if you can't shake him out of it, he's depressed and malevolent, and he's therefore hopeless. So I won't say it's evil, but he's in effect consigned himself to the walking dead. So he's not wicked, but he's certainly not the good. He is like a broken motor that can't function anymore, and basically you just give up trying to get anything from him. Now, can you make him wicked? I showed you how you could make him vicious. Can you make him wicked? Just by projection. I'm not saying he is. You'd have to have him doing things that were completely contrary to his own knowledge. Now, suppose in a mood of being down on life, I'm no good, everything is no good, people are rotten, and then somebody offers him a chance to join a party, a political party, and have power. And he knows enough to know that this is, you know, let us say a party run by Jesse Jackson and Ross Perot, so it's a real threat, you know, to individual liberty. And he says, to hell with it, I'm going to be somebody. They're all rotten swine anyway, they got what's coming to them. And with that kind of rationalization, he plunges in. Here's the guy that's going from just a private, quiet self-doubt, and suddenly it's exploding and making a massive wickedness. Now, I don't say he did it. All I say is you've got to be able to figure out what are the possibilities here and talk to him enough to decide. You or someone his age that knows it. I'll give him a book, or better still, a cassette, because unphilosophical people would rather hear than read. You got to make the information available. And by the way, if you want to draw him out, you do not do it the way I used to do as a teenager. I used to take out girls on dates, and we would just sit down at some restaurant, and I'd say, well, let's start with metaphysics. Do you believe in cause and effect? I mean, you never got anywhere in either sense. So you have to do it in a human way without taking notes. But I'm trying to show you that this guy, depending upon what you find out, might be 100% moral, completely corrupt, and as stated, there's a contradiction in the presentation, so we do not know why he has no motivation. If we give him the benefit of the doubt, I'll still like him. But if his benefit of the doubt is covering real anti-intellectuality for some motivation that's bad, then he's bad. It's just not full enough to know. Now let's look at Dick. You're going to kick me out here at a quarter after, right? 5 minutes more? Can you last an extra five? Because I had a whole other topic I wanted to get to, but... All right, let's whip through Dick now. Dick doesn't seem to have a problem with his ideas, but whether he believes them. And the two problems to him with him are his wife and his hotel. Or his hotel behavior. Now, how much weight should you give to a person's romantic choice? Now, romantic choice, of course, is a reflection, according to objectivism, of your fundamental soul and value. So you might say on the face of it, gee whiz, if I know the person that he is married to, that's the key to everything about it. Unfortunately, it does not work that way. I have rarely in my life, rarely, met a couple of whom I thought the husband and the wife were morally in even approximately the same position. There's usually tremendous disparity, not only in character and interest, but in good and not so good. And I learned very early, and in the course of time, a great many of those people got divorced. They came to see it themselves. So I quickly learned you can learn a lot about a person from what he says and what he does and what he likes, but tread easily when you get to his romantic involvement. What we want to know is, in this particular case, how does she express her Freudianism and feminism? Is she openly immoral? Is she blatantly irrationalist? Does she have a comrade Sonia-like hostility to men? I mean, a label is not enough. What if she calls herself a Freudian because she thinks it's profoundly important that Freud was like the father of the unconscious, and that she's discovered that there's so many things that are unconscious that are governing our behavior, repression is such a bad thing, you've got to learn. In other words, she takes a better element of Freud. You don't know from the fact that she calls herself a Freudian what exactly that means. And feminism, how many women have I met who say, call themselves feminists, and in every way that I can tell, have a perfectly right attitude toward men, but they have the idea that women should be paid equally for equal work. And so you argue about it and so on. And it's a small economic thing. It doesn't mean a thing. It's not, you know, like Gloria Steinem, their key to life. So if somebody applies these labels to themselves, that has to open a discussion rather than close it, just as if they said they're an objectivist and a hero worshiper. Well, what is objectivism, and is it, who is the hero, Mickey Mouse or what? Now, since it's her profession, It's more important than just chatter, you know, but you still need to know what she thinks it means, and there are more and less innocent interpretations. And above all, you have to know what does he see as the meaning of his wife's idea. Could you imagine a wicked interpretation of his relation to her, where he would be really wicked? Remember, he's a professed objectivist. Yes. But what would be motivating him? What would he get out of it that would explain such a mammoth evasion? Well, we don't make these choices just out of the blue. To make a choice of this kind, some kind of values would have to be at stake. Something he wants to destroy or achieve. Phil. What if he said, you know, I like objectivism, but it's very restrictive. It's very confining. I don't like the absolutism of it. I don't like the certainty. I like to be with someone who tells me, you know, you're crazy. It gives me a jolt of humility. I wonder, you know, do I really know what I'm talking about? And at the same time, it shows all those bastard objectivists that think they know everything. See, now that is a wicked motivation, because he is out there to destroy his alleged philosophy without admitting it. Now, we do not have evidence that that's true. Another relevant thing is here, I don't want to run these examples into the ground, but I think I've already done. What is the age of this gentleman? Does it matter if he's 18 or 60? What if he can't find an objectivist mate? He's fully aware that this woman is mixed. He would like to find somebody. He's not deceiving himself. They have a lot in common. Does that make a difference? It makes a difference if he doesn't lie. I remember a conversation I had with Ayn Rand once when I was very young, and I said about one couple that we met where the man was obviously much better than the woman. There must be something really wrong about him to have married her. I don't think I was 20 at the time. She said that doesn't follow. And the point which I never forgot, she said, is men get from women, and I guess the reverse could hold too, something incalculable in terms of sexual pleasure, the kind of pleasure that they can get from a given woman, which may be of such tremendous importance to them that they're willing to overlook an enormous amount. And not knowing that, assuming the woman is not guilty of some, you know, objective sin, then stay away from judging that. Judge him by his career, his statements, etc. And you don't know what he gets, what he sees, how she is with him, how much of her ugly behavior was nervousness and not really the same thing as she is normally, etc. So, on the face of it, this is a problem, but I agree with that gentleman back there. It doesn't have to be. Now, it can range all the way from he's corrupt to he's absolutely innocent, to what is most likely, he's mixed. Half the time he faces it, and half the time he evades it, in the hopes that it'll go away. In which case, then, you have an equally unsatisfying verdict to come to. Now, let's get rid of the one about the hotel. The ashtrays. Excuse me. He steals. What does he steal? That makes a difference. Does he take a souvenir? Ashtray. Linen. silverware for his business. Rugs and TV. Now, when it gets into these ladders, this guy is vicious. Because, I mean, he's methodically, he's become a criminal. Is his stealing occasional or regular? How does he explain and justify it? Is it all riddled with rationalization? Or does he take the attitude which I've heard decent people take some rarely? I just figured they put it down as part of the loss and you're expected to take a souvenir. Now you do in that sense need to know the picture. Just he steals sounds awful. Now I do not think it's right. I think it's always objectively wrong to take somebody else's property. But what it proves about him, there's a whole spectrum from, you know, a venial sin all the way to he's Al Capone. And you have to judge accordingly. Now you see, therefore, is either evil? I can take the exact same data and make it compatible with they're both completely virtuous or they're both wicked. It depends on the actual answers which you as a moral judge have to dig into. Is it possible for either to be evil? Absolutely. If I had to guess who is the worst of the two, just assuming a standard context, if I had to guess, I would agree with the majority here. I would guess that Dick is the worst. Because you have to make Ed really pretty corrupt, whereas futility and subjectivism and ignorance of philosophy seem like a good enough explanation. But a guy who preaches objectivism and then marries this woman and steals, even minorly, gives you a bad feeling. Now, I wouldn't make that an objective assessment, but as a preliminary, if you have to guess. Because the only inescapably immoral act, as the question is presented, is stealing. But there is still a question of the scale and the motive. Now, your relation to them will be properly determined by your evaluation. Obviously, for instance, if they wanted to borrow $5,000, and assume you had it, I would be much likelier to loan it to Ed, simply on the hotel ground. What do you like about being with them? What is it that they offer that you enjoy? Is there something that would be really important for you to give up? What do you dislike that really bothers you? Now that's relevant when you finally put down the traits to see what you're willing to tolerate and what you're not. Now if you see that they're evil or wicked, you're just cut off or vicious. But if you see that they have either confusions and or venial immoralities, you circumscribe your relation accordingly. Are they okay as a casual friend? Why not? Would you want either as a soulmate? Well, that depends what your assessment is. They both seem that they'd be okay as a babysitter. I wouldn't want Dick as my stockbroker. So in other words, before you delimit your relation, you've got to have enough knowledge of a moral evaluation and then say, this is what these people know, this is where they're immoral, here is my purpose, I make the following judgment and consequent action. So the moral of this is don't jump to moral judgment. Don't be over-condemnatory. Judge, but judge after investigation. Now, we have 10 minutes, and you said I could go 5 minutes more. There is one topic that I wanted to at least commence, and if we don't get to the end, we can steal 5 or 10 minutes next time to finish it. Up to now, I've been trying to, I said there were two problems at the outset. Those who jump to condemn and those who like to evade and escape moral judgment altogether. Now, that is not as common in the objectivist movement. But there are some cases in the objectivist movement where people go to the most incredible lengths to avoid moral judgment. It's the opposite now. They should be judging and saying, I don't know enough, I have to study further. And I want to give you a case, and I think given the time, I'll leave it right in the middle where the problem is clear but not the answer, and then I'll steal a few minutes next time. I want to give you a case where you must judge. Judge harshly, and it is excruciating to do so. And the case I have in mind is you have two good friends, really good friends. You've known them all, both a long time. They have an unbroken record, truthfulness, honor, you admire them. They have a bitter fight. You are not involved in the fight. Each of them denounces the other publicly as immoral, as an immoral, dishonest person. They may use the word evil or wicked, but at minimum they say this person is immoral. What should you do in a case like this? Now, I'm sure that has happened sometime in your life. Now, I hasten to say that what I am going to talk about does not apply to every conflict of two people that you know. Your friends may just be incompatible. They may make no charges whatever of immorality or evil. They may say, this guy is moral as far as I know. I don't like him. He never shows up on time. He's too aggressive in his manner. He doesn't cut his hair short enough. I don't like his fingernails. I don't want to be with him. But, you know, it's all within the level of the optional. In a case like that, you're entirely free to say, well, look, I want to be friends with both of you. Those things don't bother me. Or, it may involve moral issues, but you are in a position where you can't judge. And the arch example of that would be your parents decide to get divorced and you're 8 or 10 years old. And they each say awful things about the other. Now you can't judge in a situation like that. Why not? You're a child, so you don't have the understanding of adult context to enable you to judge. Plus, if they're the typical parents, they don't even charge accusations of immorality. They just say, he's greedy, he's thoughtless, he's cruel, etc., and vice versa. So that the child has been used to them denouncing each other as generally crazy and irrational. None of it comes as a surprise to him, and he can't possibly untangle it all, so he's got to basically say, you know, I'm out of it. This is an adult thing. We are talking about when you become an articulate adult. And you have friends that you've cultivated that you admire and will blow away any debt that you may have that they brought you up, etc. This is a strictly adult situation. And they've had this bitter fight and denounced each other as immoral. Well, the first question is, should you judge at all in this case? What about if you just say, I don't know the facts, I don't need to know, I'm not in the fight, I love both sides, live and let live. How many think that's an acceptable position? Well, it isn't. That would be what, philosophically, if you gave it a name? Agnosticism, and psychologically it would require evasion. Now, if these people were strangers that you don't deal with, or you deal with only, you know, in business terms, as with your grocer, you can say, I'm not involved, I don't know, I don't want to know. But here it is people that you deal with on the basis of serious friendship, people whom you respect and admire, and they themselves charge each other with being seriously immoral and undealable with. How can you ignore that? You cannot dismiss charges raised by your admired friend as unworthy of consideration. If you have so low an opinion of somebody that his charge of serious immorality is insignificant to you, you have no difficulty brushing it aside and forgetting it. That means you have no business being that individual's friend and don't actually respect him. Now, you owe your loyalty to your innocent friend. And if you just say, I don't know and I don't need to know, you are, like all agnostics, betraying the one who deserves your support. Well, could you say, I'm a graduate of the objectivist epistemology, so I got a special gimmick to get me out of this one? I took a lecture of Pigos once, and he lectured on the onus of proof. The onus of proof is on him who asserts the positive. So if anybody says so-and-so is immoral, although that's a negative statement, that's tantamount to saying he did such-and-such corrupt things, well, then the onus of proof is on the person charging. And since I don't know any proof for either side's claim, all I know is that they hate each other and hurl these accusations, but I don't know the proof. I just have to say, the charge is baseless as far as I'm concerned, therefore each is innocent on the basis of the onus of proof. And that would be very easy, as long as you stay far away from them so you never find out what it's based on. And in actual fact, in this situation, it is not devoid of all basis. Why is that? Why is it not a purely arbitrary statement if one of the friends says to the other, and in your hearing or you come to know of it, you are rotten? Why is that not an arbitrary statement to you trying to understand the situation? What? It's because this is a valued friend. Now, if a valued friend raises a serious charge, you must at minimum say the possibility exists that it's valid. There's enough possibility that I will investigate. Not a stranger, but a valued friend says this person is corrupt. You can't say, well, I don't know. I didn't see the corruption, so... So, we move to the step, you yourself are morally obligated to investigate. You cannot say, I wasn't involved, the onus of proof, or any other way out. Now, let us suppose that both friends are willing to tell you everything. Now, if they're not right there, that makes a comment on the closeness of your friendship, because the friend should be able to appreciate that this is a major issue and that you are put in an impossible position if you don't know the fact. So let's suppose your friends are objective and they're willing to tell you everything, or at least everything that either considers relevant to enabling you to decide. And you investigate, you listen, you take notes. and each gives you a detailed narrative of the whole story. What he did and said, what he didn't say. You go through both, and their stories are flat-out contradictions of each other. Each one denies boldly what the other offers as a plain fact. Now, if you think this is uncommon, you're wrong. It is very rare that there'll be a conflict, and you go to one person and say, he said you were lying, and the guy said, you're right. I mean, the very thing that makes them lie makes them refuse to admit his lies. And then there's self-deception. You can lie so much that you believe your own lies, like O.J., for instance. So what do you do in a case like this? Now, some people say, well, look, I did the investigative spade work. I don't have any independent access to reality. They deny each other boldly, so it's unknowable. I'm off the hook, and I can't judge. It's just unknowable. Now, that is exactly what the O.J. jury is being encouraged to do. In other words, the defense wants to drown them in so many contradictions and then say, any one of these is grounds for reasonable doubt. And just hook one juror's self-esteem. How can I tell? Big people say this and other people say this. Now, this is obviously corrupt and evil as a methodology, because it destroys any means of knowing anything. Disagreement does not entail unknowability. Write it down. Disagreement does not entail unknowability. And you will, if you try to remain neutral on that ground, the net effect is going to be you're going to drift away from both parties. Necessarily. You cannot love each as before because you know that at least one has a major problem. Either he's immoral, as he's been charged, or at least they've been charging things which, if not true, are irresponsible, or so intellectually screwed up that this person is not the reliable one we thought. In other words, it's virtually impossible for a small, easily misunderstood error to cause this kind of contretemps. There is something, 99 times out of 100, at the bottom of it. Somebody is immoral, and maybe there's some immorality on both sides, and somebody, and usually both, are being completely irresponsible in their statements and summaries. And if from the sheer fact of not investigating, you just leave a huge question mark over both and end up drifting away altogether. So even when confronted by contradictory reports, you have to judge. And the judgment is going to cost you one friend. Because it's going to end up being, I'm with you, goodbye. How do you judge? Now, I have four criteria, of which the most powerful is number four. And I'm going to steal a few minutes at the beginning of the next class on Friday to give you the answer. Thank you for giving me an extra 5 minutes.